Hello, my name's Paul Kleinerman. I'm a professor at Oxford and I'm the host of this podcast on immunology called To Immunity and Beyond. So this is just to say that what we're putting forward with the podcast is a scientific discussion, and it's really just for information, and it isn't in any way medical advice. So if it's medical advice you're after, please go and talk to your doctor or some other medical professional. Meanwhile, enjoy the podcast. Welcome to another episode of To Immunity and Beyond. And today I'm going to talk to Philip Goulder, who's a paediatric immunologist who's been working in Oxford for a fair number of years, as he'll describe. And we're going to talk about one of Philip's recent papers. Welcome, Philip. And perhaps, first of all, you could sort of just describe, we're going to talk about what you've done recently, but I mean, it comes, you know, in the context of a lot of previous studies in this area. So perhaps you can sort of describe your path to doing this and what you've had to set up to achieve this most recent result, which is very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose going right back, I trained in pediatrics. And so I know, you know, I always had an interest in kids. Although when I did my DPhil, it was really sort of more generally focused on what sort of immune responses, or particularly T cell responses, were going to be effective in controlling HIV. But during that time, I was lucky enough to be able to study some mother-child pairs in UK, which was you know, pretty rare thing. And still is. And, you know, became quite interested in the idea of not only how the immune system controls the virus, but how the virus evades the immune system and the consequences of the virus evading the maternal immune system, the impact that would have on the child, who obviously shares a lot of things like HLA with the mother. And so that's always been those sort of two things, you know, the general question of how we as a species can deal with HIV through, you know, vaccines or other interventions, and also the particular sort of the questions that arise or challenges that arise, I guess, for children and the opportunities in a way that studying children provide, because their immune system's so different and there's so many unique aspects to it, really. Anyway, so that was my sort of, you know, background coming in. And then I think, you know, having sort of spent the first kind of, I guess, you know, 10 or 15 years of my sort of research time focusing on T cells and control of HIV via CTL, they're then sort of the whole sort of field shifted a bit more towards cure from you know, vaccine mediated containment of HIV. And there was this sort of landmark study in 2013 describing this child, Mississippi baby, who had turned up at delivery. The mother hadn't had any antenatal care, and so this was in Mississippi, and so the mother hadn't had any prophylactic antiretroviral therapy. The child was born with an utero infection, and an antiretroviral therapy was started, you know, within minutes of the child being born. And the child was, as a lot of these kids are, unfortunately, lost to follow-up some 18 months or so later. And when they finally tracked the child down about 6 months after that, the child hadn't had any therapy for 6 months. Normally, the virus rebounds within about 14 to 21 days of stopping therapy. And the sort of viral levels of virus in the plasma are usually about a million copies at that sort of age. And this child had undetectable virus in the plasma, undetectable HIV DNA, the antibodies were negative, So there was no trace of virus at all in this child, who was now about 28 months or so, something like that, 24 months of age. And in fact, they left the child off therapy, and it was a girl. She rebounded, the virus rebounded after, I think, 28 months. And this kind of started, it was a single case, so it was a bit of a leap to make the hypothesis that maybe kids are different from adults. But if you start therapy very early, maybe given the sort of tolerogenic immune environment in early life, that it actually might be quite difficult for the virus to get a foothold in early life, in very early treated kids. And it might be that actually, it'd be possible to achieve cure or remission, as this child did, in a number of kids like this. And apart from this one single case, there were a number of studies that suggested that actually, early therapy in kids did result in very dramatic drops in the levels of HIV DNA much quicker than in adult infection, even early treated adult infection. And so there were a few reasons for thinking that actually, if you started therapy very early in kids, your chance of achieving cure, remission, might be much higher. So that's the sort of background, I guess, to how we got into this study that led to the paper. I mean, the study started in 2014. The paper was published in 2024. So, it's a very long process.
No, I totally get that. And it comes on top of a previously long process. Perhaps just for the anybody listening, there's this famous Mississippi baby, and there's like the London patient, and there's the Berlin patient. Are we still in the realm where they're just individual patients, or is enough data accumulated on these sorts of unusual cures that they're no longer kind of that special?
Well, I mean, I think, in terms of the adults or cures, I guess you have to distinguish, what's true cure, i.e. when the virus has truly been eradicated from the body, and functional cure, which is when, to all intents and purposes, it's not around. It may still be present in some form, but it's not actually manifesting itself in any way in terms of detectable viremia or any symptoms or difficulties being caused. And of course, to prove true cure is quite difficult unless you slice someone up into very small pieces and analyze every small portion of their lymphoid tissue. But, the adults, there's a handful, something like 8 or 9, I think, of adults who have probably achieved true cure as a consequence of stem cell transplantation, consequent to them developing some hematological malignancy, which would have killed them if they had not had a stem cell transplant. And if they had a transplant from somebody with Delta 32 mutation in homozygous donor, then that would not only cure their cancer, but also their HIV. So there's been a sort of handful. Obviously, that's not scalable. In terms of the kids, that there was the Mississippi baby, that there's an Africa child, and there was a third child, a Visconti child. But really, the numbers of kids who achieved cure remission had been, literally count them on the fingers of one hand. So,
before you started, it was a very, very limited number of previous cases.
I think my ambition in a way, sort of lifetime ambition, was to see if we could achieve one single cure that was unequivocal, and that you could actually, these other studies, they discovered, like the Mississippi baby, retrospectively by chance, that the child had achieved remission. They didn't have any samples at the beginning to try and understand why this had happened. All they didn't have anything, because they couldn't get detectable virus, and there was just no antibody, nothing. So if you were able to do a prospective study, so this is what we then did, starting in 2014, was, you know, collecting the samples that were the ones that actually made the diagnosis. Because in these kids, I mean, nowadays, you know, the transmission rate from mother to child is incredibly low. The in utero transmission rate's about 0.4%. And in the old days, without therapy, about 7% of kids would be infected via in utero transmission, about 18% intrapartum, you know, at the time of delivery, and then another 25% postpartum through breast milk. So the advent of antiretroviral therapy has really cut that down massively. Yeah, I mean, the idea was, I was saying, to try and do this study prospectively, so you had the samples at the very beginning, because the best kids, the kids most likely to achieve remission, are those who have lost all trace of virus quite quickly. So unless you have those early time points, you've got nothing to work with. And particularly now, you know, more than 90% of the babies born with HIV, the mothers are already, you know, they're on therapy at the time of delivery, which gets across the placenta. So you may only have, you know, that the time when you do the diagnosis, that time point to actually get your hands on the virus and then try and find out if these kids do subsequently become, you know, cured or in remission. What are the sort of mechanisms underlying, which is what I wanted to get to.
Perhaps before we get into the results, perhaps you could just explain that it's a very it's quite an amazing setup that you've got in South Africa with all this prospective kind of following of large, very large numbers of people. So just I mean, that obviously has taken in a lot of effort to set up. Perhaps you could just give the context to how the sampling was done and what the study cohort was and what's all around it in order to make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in working in Africa anyway, just from my sort of background of having spent some time there before. And I think it was coincidental that the HIV epidemic, you know, exploded in sub-Saharan Africa. And so also coincidental that the sort of epicenter of the whole thing was in the province of KwaZulu-Natal, which is a population of about 10 million people in northeastern part of South Africa, and really had been incredibly badly treated in the apartheid era. There were no facilities or sort of research culture or buildings or personnel or infrastructure to really study this massive epidemic that was kind of exploding. And it just so happened that this was the time that I was, you know, looking to try and study this question of what are the immune responses that control the virus. And, you know, the virus in South Africa is different from the virus that was being studied in North America and UK and Europe, being a C-clade virus. And the populations, of course, are very different, with the HLA types being, you know, completely, in many cases, that the critical HLAs that control the virus are just not even expressed in Caucasian populations, or the ones that people are studying in non-African populations. So I think I was lucky to sort of come in at the time when we had these kind of quite nice assays, like ELISpot assays that were just available at that time, that enabled you to do quite sort of broad screening of immune responses in huge numbers of people. I mean, we were sort of studying, you know, more than 1,000 people and characterizing their responses, and so getting to the responses that were most effective. And we were lucky to get some funding to build a research institute in Durban, which hadn't been any building in the university for, I think, 50 plus years. So all of that, I think, was fundamental to what's happened later. You know, to have this kind of epidemic happening in KZN, it's pretty important to be able to study it in KZN. You know, most of the work that we've done has been done in the labs in KwaZulu-Natal, in University of KwaZulu-Natal. But through sort of strong links with our group in Oxford, and also I was working in Boston with Bruce Walker at what was then the Mass General Hospital and became the Reagan Institute. And that sort of link as well has been really important in providing sort of foundations and critical mass of people to enable the kind of science, the science to be done at the same time as doing these sort of clinical research studies to try and, I mean, in some cases, we were initiating antiretroviral therapy in kids with HIV at a time when that was definitely not, you know, the government policy. Yeah. I mean, you know, antiretroviral therapy was only rolled out in, started being rolled out in 2004, you know, years after it was saving lots of lives in UK and North America. So I mean, that's the kind of background. And then, as I say, you know, by the time we got to 2014, when we were planning this study on the back of the Mississippi baby paper, you know, the rates of transmission were much lower, and it was much harder to make the diagnosis in these kids because of the antiretroviral therapy that the mothers had. And the kids were all put on prophylactic therapy, any child born to a positive mother, prompt therapy at birth. So we used point of care testing in about a third of the cases that we enrolled. I mean, the cohort now is about 350 mother-child pairs, which is, you know, massive compared to any other cohorts, mother-child pair cohorts around today. Obviously, these sort of size cohorts you could access in the kind of, you know, 80s and 90s in Southern African countries, but you know, that's an incredible cohort, and to get to follow those kids up is very challenging, because, you know, the reason why these mothers are transmitting now when this antiretroviral therapy is available is for two main reasons. One is because there are massive social issues, which for reasons, perhaps because, you know, to do with stigma, the mothers themselves don't feel able to take therapy, that perhaps they're dependent on for you know, where they live, on somebody who just won't let them take therapy or even admit they're infected. So that there's massive social issues. And then the second reason is when the mothers don't know they're infected themselves, which is often when they are getting infected during pregnancy, which is probably about two thirds of the kids we enroll, which seems a kind of quite a stunning thing to think about here. But anyway, that's another story in a way. But it means that, you know, despite the fact that there's a lot of, you know, most 99% of mothers with HIV are on therapy, and, you know, by and large, the virus is suppressed in those mothers. You know, there is a very small number who are either seroconverting, in which case the transmission rates are quite high, or they just can't take therapy for various social reasons.
Okay, so that's what you kind of set this all up over years, basically. And then tell us about the study as published then. So what did you discover?
Yeah, so I suppose that we were, you know, looking, you know, and weren't expecting to see a lot of Mississippi babies, because in order to do that, you need to sort of enroll them and then follow them up and then wait for them to be lost to follow up and then find them again. You know, there's a kind of unlikely scenario.
Yes.
And so instead, what we were trying to do was to measure the levels of HIV, the total HIV DNA, as a kind of proxy for their chances of achieving cure remission. But I guess there were a couple of things that that happened unexpectedly, as all the best things are unexpected in science, I guess. And the first thing was that we had a set of twins where the mother was one of these ones who hadn't had any therapy during pregnancy. In fact, she had become infected during pregnancy because she was negative shortly before. She had a male and a female twin. I mean, her viral load was a million copies at delivery. And one of the twins had a viral load of 54 million, and that was a female. And the male twin was uninfected. And that sort of seemed quite striking because it's not just a single exposure. These two twins had been sitting exposed to high levels of virus for a long time, and yet one had got infected, and you know, with obviously a very a virus that could grow to quite high levels. And actually in the cohort overall, we found that females were much more susceptible to infection than males. We had five sets of twins where the sexes were different, where one became infected, and in all of those cases it was the female. And one other factor that sort of came into all this, another clue, was that the female fetal susceptibility was limited to when the mothers were infected in pregnancy or just before, or you know, recently infected. So if the mothers were already positive prior to delivery, prior to pregnancy, there was no difference in susceptibility for the infants. Ratio is 1:1. These things were quite sort of interesting. And on top of that, we did actually find some Mississippi-like babies. I mean, as I said, this was published in 2024, and we started enrolling actually in 2015. And so it takes a long time to, you know, have this whole process happen where there's a child who is, you know, who gets treated. All these kids were treated very early. The ones we diagnosed by point of care, the median time of starting triple therapy was 24 hours. They all started therapy, one or two drug therapy at birth. So it was incredibly early. But I mean, nonetheless, we found five kids who were like the Mississippi baby. They were maintaining undetectable viral loads for more than 3 months. In one case, it was now up to 4 years without any therapy, and they had been lost to follow up, but we'd found them again. So it was a unscheduled treatment interruption these kids were having. It wasn't that we had initiated anything. It was an entirely observational study, and all these five kids were males. So essentially, we'd found, you know, first that females were more susceptible to infection, and that second, although 60% of the cohort was female, the five kids who had achieved this remission through unscheduled treatment interruption were all male. So, I mean, we started to look at these viruses that were transmitted, and to look at the difference between the males and females in sex discordant twin sets. And our hypothesis was, I suppose, that you know, we'd seen in adult studies that there are some quite interesting sex differences in the way that the virus is controlled by males and females, in that in acute infection, the viral set point, the initial level of controlled virus is lower in females. Females, this is in adults, appear to have a better control of the virus. That being said, though, over the longer term, they for a given viral load, they progress more rapidly than males. And there were some studies in published in 2008. In which this had been related to activation of or production of type 1 interferon by plasmacytodendritic cells as a result of exposure or sensing of single-stranded RNA from HIV. And females produce more of type 1 interferon as a consequence of exposure to HIV, their immune system is more activated. The cells that the virus infects are these activated memory CD4 T cells. So it sort of made sense that if female fetuses sort of share this increased production of type 1 interferon by their PDCs in response to exposure to HIV and other single-stranded RNA viruses, then they would have more immune activation. They'd be more susceptible. And, you know, this immune activation is a double-edged sword, you know, across the entire immune system. You know, on the one hand, you've got the advantages in, let's say, adult acute HIV infection, where the quicker your immune system can get activated, the more you've got a chance of beating the virus down. You know, there's very clear data essentially showing that your viral set point is related to time of immune activation. But if you have too much immune activation, obviously that fuels the fire of viral replication and disease progression. So you have this kind of balance. But in fetal life, it might be that, you know, you don't actually have the benefits of greater immune activation because you haven't got things like your CD8 T cells that are coming in to, you know, bring down the virus, because that arm of the immune response is not supported in early life. So anyway, cut a long story short, when he looked at the viruses that are transmitted to males and females, they're completely different. The viruses transmitted to males tend to be very interferon sensitive and quite fit viruses. So reflecting the fact that it's quite difficult to infect males, and the females, much easier to many more infections, and generally more interferon resistant viruses are being transmitted, and often quite low fitness viruses are able to be transmitted and flourish in the setting of the female early life immune system. So, I mean, we were. I think that was probably the most sort of exciting part of the whole thing, in a way, where, you know, we take it for granted that, you know, male and female are different in terms of their immune system as adults. And, you know, people, I think, I mean, not pediatricians, because they're a bit different, but, you know, generally people think, well, the real sex differences happen from puberty. But here, you know, actually we're seeing, even in utero, there are sufficient sex differences that it affects whether you get infected with viruses like HIV, and in fact this applies also to other viruses like HCV, but also whether your chances of achieving cure remission from a virus like HIV. And, you know, we could see in the general cohort as a whole that the viral loads were lower at baseline in the males than in the females, this sort of would fit with the fact
they're lower at baseline, even though they had a fitter virus. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that is. I think, you know, your viral load is a kind of result of a lot of different effects, and if you've got, you know, imagine an immune system where none of the cells are activated, there's no CCR5 expressed, and there's no co-receptor that the virus can get in by, then it doesn't really matter if your virus, I mean, there's no direct line in correlation between fitness and viral load, because, you know, you've also got to factor in the fact that, you know, there isn't any substrate for the virus to grow. Okay.
The virus is fit, but it has to be fit. That's the only way it gets into this barren land.
Yes. You know, it's basically landing on, you know, a complete desert in terms of somewhere for the thing to grow in. And so, you know, if the virus, and, you know, the fact that the viruses are interferon resistant in the female sort of implies that they have to evade some stronger interferon response in the females, and also that there's some cost to doing that. And, you know, that the males, the virus that they have transmitted obviously comes from their mother. And if you look, we looked at the relationship between interferon sensitivity and viral load in the mothers, and there's quite a strong correlation between viral load in the mothers and interferon resistance. So if you have a highly interferon resistant virus, your viral load is higher. So that sort of fits with because the viral loads in donor and recipient are quite closely related. It fits with the fact that, or consistent with the fact that, the viral loads at baseline in the male kids are lower to start off with. You know, they've got interferon sensitive virus and their mothers have low viral loads. So I guess that's those are the main the main things that sort of came out of the study. And essentially we found these kids that were able to achieve cure remission. We had the viruses from the very outset, and we could see that there's a difference between the males and females, which would explain why males have a high propensity for achieving cure. And in those particular five kids that we identified as achieving some degree of cure remission through the unscheduled treatment interruption, the viruses had very low replicative capacity. That they were quite distinct from the viruses that were generally transmitted to the sort of more typical males. And so that's sort of, I guess, going on to some of the things we're exploring a bit more now. But I think the sex difference aspect was really exciting, but also the fact that, you know, there'd only been like one or two or three individual cases previously described in which they hadn't actually had the virus at baseline. And, you know, people are very reasonably quite skeptical when you have a single anecdotal case, you know, and a lot of people just not really convinced that they really were infected. And, you know,
you've convinced them now, I hope.
Well, I think if you have the viruses and, you know, in some cases they have rebounded perhaps after 24 months, and, you know, the virus that comes out is the same, you know, is related to the virus that went in, you know, so although you feel disappointed that they haven't, you know, remained in remission, nonetheless, you can learn a huge amount from the cases that fail. You know, they can teach you what immune responses that rebounding virus needed to evade to come back. I think and in addition, it does kind of confirm once more that, you know, they were truly infected in the first place, for anyone who's skeptical.
So Philip, just one last question then. So where do you take all of this? So now you've done this huge piece of work that took a decade, etc. What's the next follow-up?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this study that was published in Nature Medicine in 2024 was entirely an observational study, and we were just kind of picking up scraps, you know, what we could learn from the fact that some people by chance were being lost to follow up, and we were able to capture those because we were obviously going to miss quite a few people who perhaps were stopping therapy but were continuing to be followed up, because we're not measuring their levels of drug in their blood all the time. You know, obviously expensive thing to do unless we've got reason to believe they're not taking therapy and want to sort of identify these type of kids. And also there are, you know, a lot of kids who are stopping therapy in an unscheduled way and rebounding very quickly. And so, you know, in order to actually learn more, we wanted to do a prospective treatment interruption study as part of a trial where we enrolled some of these kids and stopped therapy at a particular time. And then you could measure time to rebound and perhaps identify some extra kids that were not dependent on being lost to follow-up for being identified. And we have started that trial. We've got 19 kids enrolled so far, three of whom, three additional ones to the five we had before, have achieved cure remission as defined by more than 12 weeks. aviremia from stopping therapy. I should say in adult studies, 1% of adults maintain aviremia for 12 weeks after stopping therapy. So 12 weeks is quite a short time, but it's pretty unusual to go that far. And, you know, of those three, one has gone beyond 24 months already. So, you know, these are super interesting. But we also want to do an antibody trial, a trial using broadly neutralizing antibodies, because these are, you know, in non-human primate studies and in adult studies, I think the most promising immunotherapeutic intervention for helping facilitate HIV cure. And I think in these kids who've been started very early, if they were given the opportunity to have antiretroviral therapy, or early antiretroviral therapy, and then broadly neutralizing antibodies, which can boost the immune response through so-called vaccinal effects, as well as actually blocking virus infection through binding to preventing the virus from getting into CD4 cells. I think we'll get a lot more cures, and I think we'll learn a lot more about mechanisms of cure, and that'll apply not only to kids, where I think it's probably easier to achieve this, but also more broadly to adults as well. So that's my sort of that's our plan. We're hoping to start that broadly neutralizing antibody trial called the SNOW trial in about a year's time. And so that is our sort of, you know, current goal.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. I mean, I think it's an incredible story with amazing results as well as really cool science. So thanks very much for describing it all so clearly today. Yeah, it's amazing. And we hope that anybody listening to this will enjoy that, and they can access the paper. We'll put it all up on the website, and we'll put up any other related things if that helps people dig into this a little bit more. So thanks a lot, Philip.
Fantastic. Great. Thanks very much.